Hello and welcome back to Out of Office. I'm your host, Malika Kapoor. When Julia Hartz was a teenager, she got a job at a local cafe called The Ugly Mug. She worked long hours there. She was the one who turned the lights on in the morning, and she was the one who turned them off every night. She says this experience was transformative and greatly influenced her work ethic. And today, as a co-founder and CEO of Eventbrite, she draws on what she learned serving coffee to serve Eventbrite users around the world. As you probably know, Eventbrite is a live events platform, so naturally the pandemic was brutal for the company. The company was issuing refund after refund, but Julia wasn't about to see the company fold. She says she activated her mama bear. She got fierce. She moved fast. And in this episode of Out of Office, she talks about how she pulled Eventbrite back from the brink. Here's Julia Hartz on Out of Office. Julia, welcome to Out of Office.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to see you.
The live events business, Eventbrite, is a platform that gives you all the tools to bring people together, organizing an event, tickets, marketing. We're at a very interesting time in history now. Hopefully, the worst of the pandemic is behind us. People are coming together. What's bringing people together?
Well, it's such an interesting time, as you said. I mean, we're coming out of, honestly, one of the most impactful global societal shared experiences. If you think about the fact that not one human on the planet was not impacted in some way by the pandemic, it's just this remarkable time. And I think that people are coming out, they're getting out of their homes, they're coming together mostly to celebrate right now, really to be together and enjoy each other's company, whether it's at a music festival or a, you know, art show. And I think that as we continue to process what's happened through the pandemic and frankly, the collective trauma of the social isolation, I think we're going to see new ways of gathering emerge. And, you know, I think, and I hope that we'll continue to get together as communities to solve problems. We're certainly starting to see that. I mean, I live in San Francisco, which has, you know, it's a beautiful gem of a city, and we have our fair share of problems. And we're starting to really see citizens come together to solve those problems at a grassroots level, which is exciting. There's, you know, weekend street cleanups. There's a program where you can adopt a street. There's live music being played outdoors. It's a sort of renaissance. And I think that if that's a microcosm of hopefully what's happening around the world in different ways, you know, I have a lot of hope for the future.
During the pandemic, I want to take you back just a couple of years. I mean, you're in the live events business. You know, how worried were you? Was there a moment when you thought, my God, I might have to shut Eventbrite down? Did that thought occur to you?
Well, I think that there's a really unique experience and story in what happened. Certainly, we weren't the only ones, but we were at the tip of the spear during COVID. And to see the impact of a business that I and my teammates have spent 14 years building essentially go away in 14 days was surreal at best, pretty terrifying. But in the moment, in the crisis, there was only one fleeting moment where I thought, how is this actually happening? How is something that we've been spent so many years, so much blood, sweat, and tears, you know, building, go, like, it just was this moment of like, how can this be so fleeting? And then I turned that moment into just, you know, focus and energy around saving what I knew to be this really important place in the world where we, you know, sit and what we help people do, and really turning that energy into how can we help our creators survive? Because the impact was devastating. I mean, live events were mandated not to happen. gathering was something that, you know, that officials were saying not to do. So the entire basis of our business, the entire reason why we exist, went away again in the span of like 2 weeks. And so what we did was we turned our energy, our attention, our, you know, just stubbornness, I guess, on how we could help our customers survive. And that really helped us, that buoyed us through the crisis. But I would say personally, I activated the mama bear, and like, it was quite fierce. I really had no idea what I would be like in a crisis like that, because I hadn't led through a crisis quite like that before.
When you say you activated the mama bear, what did you do?
Well, I moved fast, and, you know, it wasn't just me. It was a collective, I would say, of about 50 people, both internally on the team as well as externally, and it included our board, my co-founder and husband, Kevin, and some advisors around us who just care a lot about what we've created. And we made the very, very difficult decision to downsize the company in order to really survive the impact of, we were generating negative revenue at the time. So, I mean, we were actually generating more refunds than revenue because events were being canceled. And we were refunding consumers. And we centered that decision around a go forward strategy that would really anchor us. And it was really, it was very important to me that we make these decisions based on something that was really meaningful and that we would be working on for a few years' time. It wasn't just in the moment reactive and sort of making short-term decisions. And we shored up the company's finances, and we did all of that in less than 90 days. So it was a really, I would say speed was the thing that I activated the most in you know, the way that I led through that. And decisiveness. I mean, you really didn't have time to second guess decisions.
I read somewhere that you came home one day in March 2020 and found that your husband had set up a war room. Tell me about that.
Well, we have a home office. It's actually where I'm sitting right now. And I was the last person in the office. I wanted to really make sure everybody got home and safe. And, you know, those early days were really, really scary and just uncertainty everywhere. And I hugged our CFO and I actually started crying and I felt like, oh gosh, we had only worked together for a few months. And I thought, oh, he's probably going, oh gosh, is she going to be able to do this? It was the last tear that I shed for a very long time, but I was devastated because I knew, I mean, again, we were at the tip of the spear, so we could see it, what was happening globally. And I just knew this was going to be sort of almost an age defining moment. And so I came home and I walked into the house, and in our office, Kevin had been at home, had been setting up these gaming monitors that are really long and they're like curved. And he had a bunch of them set up so that it was almost this 360, you know, sphere of like information. And then there were two chairs in the middle of it. There were whiteboards. And it was truly, I said that it was a romantic moment. It really was, because the two chairs meant I wasn't alone. It wasn't like one singular chair, you know, command and control center. He was really saying to me with that action, I'm going to drop everything. I mean, he has his own career and you know, set of challenges and things to do. And he was going to drop everything and join me as a co-founder and help all of us, you know, get through that moment. And so it was a really intense time.
I was quite fascinated when I read that you did call it a romantic moment.
That's a lot about me.
But I get it. I mean, it's someone showing up for you, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that you know, any CEO and certainly, you know, co-founder, I think it's so cliche when people say it's a lonely job, but there are moments where you realize that no one's coming to save you. You are going to need to lead through this. And I think that it was a really kind gesture for him to show that I wasn't going to be all on my own. And we've grown our relationship through being co-founders. We were engaged when we started Eventbrite. So we started as a couple, but I think just so much of what our lives have been around building a business, building a company, building a team that we really believe in. And that buoys a lot of our life and it connects a lot of who we are and what we do. And so in that moment, it just felt pretty similar to like, if you have a sick kid or something where you just come together and you focus, you make it happen. So that meant a lot to me, as did, again, probably 50 people who dropped everything to help us.
Now, Kevin, your husband has been a big part of your professional story, your professional journey as well. You're both co-founders of Eventbrite. So two questions here. What was your strategy to work together? Because that could be tricky when you're working so closely with your husband, right?
Well, you know, I think when we started it, yes, I should validate what you just said. Yes, it is tricky. It's not for everybody. I think when we started the company, it was really unheard of. There were only bad stories of couples who had either broken up or who had, their companies hadn't worked out. We didn't really have any positive examples except for one. And they're some of our closest friends, Michael and Sochi Birch, who founded Bebo and Birthday Alarm together. And when we asked them for their advice, they said, divide and conquer, never work on the same thing at the same time ever. And we really took that to heart and used it as one of our principles. And it worked well for us because we have very complementary skills. And I should point out that we had a third co-founder, still do, Renaud Visage, who joined us shortly after we decided to work together. And so it was the three of us. And I think that was really helpful to balance out all of our specialties and superpowers. And so, you know, we bootstrapped the company for 2 years. We spent less than $250,000 getting Eventbrite to product market fit, to traction, to a place where folks were really coming to Eventbrite and using it at a significant scale. And I'm pretty proud of that. And I really look back at that time as a signal and a validation of the functionality that we had as a group and as co-founders. And then when we went to go out and raise our first round of funding, that's when we needed to, you know, obviously address the elephant in the room because it was still not a real popular notion. And so we would just start every meeting by addressing it. And that's very Kevin and I. We're very transparent. We like to just, you know, get it out there, do the right thing. And I think that really helped us build trust in those meetings. And then ultimately, you know, Sequoia Capital decided to support us and have been, you know, an incredible support system to us throughout the last 15 years. And I think that there are more and more co-founding couples now. I mean, I certainly feel like it's something that people can see and, you know, maybe decide that that's right for them. But I think it is tricky because you never quite get to turn it off, right? I get asked a lot, you know, when do you turn it off? And it's like, well, never really, because we both care so deeply about this company that it's a benefit that we can always talk about it.
And then when Kevin decided to step down as CEO, you were president when he was CEO. Can you walk me through what was going on in your head when you decided that you would step in as CEO and you would take over as CEO rather?
Well, I don't know if most people feel ready for that. Maybe there are people who do feel very ready. I felt like it was an honor, a privilege, and a responsibility to step into that role if I could. And certainly it was the board's decision. So, you know, I respected either way it was going to work out. And I think that, you know, knowing that I'm not the same person as Kevin and knowing that there's going to be different things that I do well or that I'm drawn to was something that we could be really mindful about and that I could make sure that I surrounded myself with people who, you know, could complement that. But I made a joke to Kevin after the first couple of months, like, you know, you made it look so easy. Like I feel like I was in Candyland and now I'm in Tron. this is not easy. And so I just deeply respect the way that he approached the role, because it can get to your head very quickly. I think probably, I don't know, 80% of it is how you as the leader can take care of yourself, activate the things in you, that the will to lead is kind of how I think about it, like how you can be the most consistent in that. And it is really an endurance sport. So I've gotten much, much better at it over the past, you know, I guess 6 years. But I love the way that every day I'm learning something new and it's unlocking knowledge. I'm so addicted to learning and kind of infatuated with the idea that you're always improving. But I'm delighted now that I start to see things that I've seen before and I can pattern match. So I'm sort of in this like sweet spot of my CEO tenure, you know, and I feel really grateful for that. And I think Kevin's been really helpful. But you also have to have a strong sense of self to not be asking yourself, well, how would he do it differently? And then he's right here. I can ask him how he would do it differently. Right. And so it's challenging, you know, as well.
What's the one leadership quality you value the most, especially as a CEO?
I think consistency over all else. I think that it's something that I both value and something that I work on the most. Because I think that you can be brilliant and you can be kind and you can be brave and you can be shrewd. And there are all these qualities that really celebrated leaders have. But I think consistency is something that is really difficult to achieve and maintain at a high performance level. And why I think consistency is so important is because in any ecosystem with humans involved, like there is great power in being able to anticipate and being able to create pattern recognition and being able to come back to a North Star, whether it's the principles, the values, the mission. And it's difficult to achieve. Like, I think that I'm in pursuit of that, especially now that I feel far more confident and capable leading this company. And I know, you know, I can really like understand where my kind of opportunities lie and the influence that I can have on this incredible company. It's really, I think, the consistency that matters, and where you see, if you like read biographies of great leaders, there's that theme threaded throughout. And I just don't think it gets the airtime, right? It doesn't, like, it's not a sexy subject to talk about consistency.
But I'm fascinated that you picked that, because I do interview a fair number of CEOs, and I have to be honest, it's the first time I've heard that. Can you explain that a little bit more deeply? When you say consistency, is it being consistent to your mission? Is it being consistent to showing up in the same way for your employees? What does consistency mean to you? In what way do you want to embrace consistency?
So I would say it's all of the above that you mentioned. But to me, it means that a leader has the self-awareness to understand a situation and to run it back through a filter and through an organizational system that allows for them to turn whatever information that's coming in or whatever they're feeling, because we're all humans, right, into something that's actually productive for the company. And that's consistently applied across different situations, different challenges. So it's almost like a groundedness, I would say. Mm-hmm. And it's a way to be able to build trust. It's a way to be able to, you know, build belief. It's a way to be able to connect with the people you work and you care for. But I think so often humans get caught in mirroring a reaction to a situation based on whatever that situation is, you know, right? And so if it's a, you know, if it's a crisis, you are heightened in your emotionality, you are, you know, focused, you are aggressive, you are this. I actually think that is the sign of an immature leader. And it's not that we all need to go be, you know, like some, you know, Buddha, but I think we honestly could learn some really important lessons from, you know, folks who have shown and threaded through their lives and their missions and their career, just a consistent set of values and a consistent way of showing up in the world that has a really quiet power that I think we could use a lot more of, right? Especially in the time where it's sort of reaction begets, you know, like the way that we consume media and information and so on and so forth.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Eventbrite is your baby, your passion, your company now, but you've had some pretty interesting jobs before, starting at the age of 14, when you worked at a coffee shop called The Ugly Mug, and you'd be the first in and turn the lights on, you'd be the last to leave turning the lights off. Tell me about your experience at The Ugly Mug, and do you think those early years of working there have influenced your work ethic?
I do. I mean, you know, I'm very aware of the people in my life now who had an outsized impact, and I didn't realize it back when I was a child. I think that's probably pretty common. But in hindsight, as I collect more data points and I'm reflective on who I am, and I think also having children of this age, you know, makes you really be tapped into what formative experiences you had that led to you being who you are, good, bad, and indifferent. And one for me was definitely the Ugly Mug. I mean, I love that. I'm so delighted that this is part of my life that I worked at this coffee place, and the name of it. And what was special about it was I grew up in a small beach town, very close community. The founder of the Ugly Mug moved into town, was sort of a peculiar guy. He was very, very passionate about coffee. So he brought this beautiful manual Italian machine that was probably the only one in our town. And he was meticulous about training his staff on how to use it. And the Ugly Mug was an ode to the fact that he brought all of his mug collection with him to this tiny town and set up shop. And the mugs were everywhere. We served drinks in them. They were all over them. I mean, it was just like, it's still there today. You can go see it in SoCal, California. And it just, I think it taught me a lot about excellence, about craft, about attention to detail, about, you know, being meticulous. And I was just this high school kid and I'm learning how to draw the perfect espresso shot. Mm. And so that was the first lesson. The second lesson was customer service, because the minute I was behind the counter, and yes, I would do the early shift. There was always this one woman who would come in on Saturday mornings. She would stand outside at 5:59 and I'd open the door at 6 a.m. and she would walk in. And any drink I made her, no matter what it was, and she'd actually order different drinks every week, which was interesting. Yeah. She hated it and she'd send it back and make me do it again. And I was terrified of this woman because she also would just tell me like how much my latte sucked. And so it was very negative. And then I finally realized about 4 weeks in that she just wanted someone to talk to. Oh. And instead of going back and forth about the drink, I started stealing my parents' local newspaper with me on the way out the door. And I'd put it on the counter and she'd walk in and I would point to like any kind of story and be like, what do you think about that? And we'd start talking about that. And all of a sudden she loved my drinks. And so that was a big lesson for me, right? Like of empathy, of understanding customer needs. And I don't know how I would have gotten that lesson in life if it hadn't been for that experience.
That is a great lesson. And I have to say, as a 14-year-old, well done on you to pick that up, that, you know, to realize that all she needed was company. I mean, she was obviously just lonely in that she was reaching out for something else, not just a latte.
That's true.
And then later on, you were an intern on the set of Friends. Yeah. Was that fun? Was that intimidating? Tell me about that.
Oh, gosh. I mean, another surreal experience. It was overwhelming, I would say. It was at the height of the Friends frenzy. Uh-huh. And there was just a lot going on. And I think what was challenging for me was the kind of culture of secrecy and paranoia that persisted because it was such a huge hit that everything had to be, you know, very protected, the storylines, the guest stars, and it just created this really kind of bad culture, I would say. Mm-hmm. Now I was very young, so I kind of want to discount myself a bit, but it was my worst job because it was, and which would seem strange, you know, I was on the set with these mega stars and you're in the height of the zeitgeist, but it was just really a challenging environment. However, I have to say that the cast, they were very, very tight and insular and almost like, you know, they were in their own vortex of this massive fame. And they were delightful to one another. And honestly, to the crew, it was just everything else around it was super difficult. And my job as intern was to answer the set phone and to go find whoever was calling. So I walked around with this big wireless phone. And I can just say without a doubt, it created a phone phobia that I have barely recovered from. I'm going to have to work that out eventually.
Did anyone interesting call?
Well, anyone who has the number to the Friends set at that moment in time, they were all really interesting people, right? Or powerful people, I would say, but they weren't very patient. And they weren't very kind.
Get Jennifer and get her now.
Yes. It was terrifying. So I'm still getting over my phone phobia.
So I read a really interesting story about you going to college. You had a dream college. You got accepted, but it was really expensive. At that time, you didn't have the funds to go there. So you wrote them a letter saying how much you wanted to go. And the next thing you knew is you got a scholarship to go there. I want to know, what did you write in that letter?
Well, I should say that I got financial aid. So I was, okay. which meant that I was indebted to the college and to student loans for quite some time. But I, you know, I think I was very sure about where I wanted to be and why I wanted to be there. And so that's what I wrote in my letter was, you know, the like desire to be in that community, to be in a small liberal arts college, to be, you know, like a part of that community. And then, you know, just the why behind wanting to go. And I thought it was it was going to be just tossed in the trash. Right. And my mom had told me to write the letter and I'm like, okay, mom. And 2 days before I was having to commit to my very, very distant number two choice, I received a huge envelope in the mail and I'll never, ever forget that. It stuffed our little mailbox. And it was just such a thrilling moment. And I often think about who read that letter. Mm. And what, I mean, that person is truly responsible for a lot of my life. And yeah. I'll never know who it is. And of course, I just recently thought about that. So, you know, the chances of me finding who they are probably pretty slim, but it's incredible to think about these just seemingly small moments. It was probably just, you know, a normal mundane day for that person. And they decided, oh, this person really wants to go here. Let's offer them more financial aid. And like,
give them a chance.
Everything to me. Yeah.
Yes. Let's give her a chance. Yes. I want to talk to you quickly about being a woman in the tech sector, being a woman in Silicon Valley. First of all, I was just wondering, while we were talking just now, when you took over as CEO of Eventbrite after your husband, Kevin, had been CEO, you were a woman leading it. Was there any difference in the way people viewed the company or in the funding or the support the company got because it was being led by a woman?
You know, I kind of laugh because it's like, yeah, I'm a woman and there's not a lot of us in these positions. So it's really important. Yeah. I think that like we stay in it. I had a lot of privilege. And, you know, I mean that sincerely. I wasn't a solo founder. I had the backing and support of titans of industry, right? Like one of the most revered venture firms in Sequoia Capital. And Roelof Botha, who was on our board for 13 years and has been a friend for 20, really through his involvement in several businesses that Kevin's been involved in, you know, he's also one of my kind of mentors and great mentors or your biggest critics. And I remember him saying, be careful what you wish for. Like this is going to be a steep climb. But I'm going to be right there with them. I'm going to be behind you. And they really walked the walk. I mean, there was never a moment where I felt alone. And I think that when you do have that kind of support system, you know, that in addition to the other investors we had involved in Eventbrite at the time, we were still a private company, and our board, our lead independent director, Sean Moriarty, is an incredible coach to me. When you have that kind of support, I think it's a great privilege. And so that's, I feel like it's now my mission to go find women who don't have that support and become that support, because it means all the difference in the world. It's not about opening doors or making connections. It's about knowing that you have someone to turn to when you don't know the answer, or frankly, just the feeling of people having your back, right? And that, I think, to any human is going to be powerful. And so what excites me about the time we're living in now is that there is more and more women, not only in the role as CEO, and again, there's not enough women running mm-hmm. their own companies publicly in the public markets, right? Yeah. But thinking about the ecosystem of more women venture, more women in private equity, more women at the table around, you know, board discussions. I don't know. I'm an eternal optimist on this, but I hosted dinner that is, you know, women founders and CEOs, and that I can't fit them around my table anymore, right? Like we have to keep getting bigger and bigger space. So that to me is my own little microcosm of something's working. And let's keep going. And I think there's some really interesting women founders in AI that I'm so excited about. So I just say I can see the change and the path forward. And at the same time, you know, it's bittersweet when we ring the bell on the New York Stock Exchange and they came out and said they looked through their archives and they couldn't find a balcony that had as many women on it as we did. Mm-hmm. And that was just our executive team. It wasn't, you know, when the trader who opened our stock said he'd never seen this many kids on the trading floor. And that was just us bringing our families. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like a kid event. and so it's just those kind of moments could strike me as like, wow, I can't believe that this is still where we are. So there's, you know, it's kind of dynamic.
When you get these women around your, table. Mm-hmm. 1 minute warning. Can I keep you for just maybe 2-3 minutes extra? Yep. Okay. I'll be quick. When you get these women around your table, what are they talking about? What's priority?
Well, I would say, you know, it's a mosaic of topics. It's, you know, we're all speaking the same language. So certainly like with any group that you have affinity with, it's, you know, comforting to know that you're facing some of the similar challenges, whether it's running a public company through this crazy volatile time, or it's, you know, raising funding, or it's building a team. Like, I mean, there's just so much commonality between our experiences, but also life. I mean, it's nice to be able to get together with women who are running companies, being leaders, and also building their lives. And I think that there's just such a diversity around the table. It's not one demographic. And I really work hard at that, because I think that's actually where you end up getting the fullness and richness of an experience like that. I've been in plenty of experiences where it's all the same, you know, era of women leaders. Yeah. And there's value in that. But I think the greater value is in giving people seats around the table who are just absolutely in different stages and phases of their lives and have very, very different experiences. And so that's what I'm really passionate about in terms of that particular gathering.
Julia, this podcast is called Out of Office. What's your favorite thing to do when you're not in the office?
Well, golly. I mean, traveling with my family is just the thing that I live for. So, you know, I'm the cruise director of my entire family. So I get to be very, very directive in this pursuit, which I think is probably a big part of it. But I would say that they get to benefit from my leadership in that way, because we do some pretty awesome traveling together. So we went to Egypt over in 2021, which was a big trip to take during that time, but it was a magical trip. And so, you know, I love to try to find new ways that we can be together in different environments. And I would say that's my biggest passion outside of Eventbrite.
Do you have any exciting trips planned this year?
We are going to go to Spain, and I haven't spent a lot of time there. We have over 150 Breitlings in the country. And so I'm excited to see. We often combine Eventbrite with travel. Our last trip before COVID hit was to Mendoza, Argentina, to see our team there and bring our girls there. So, you know, it's going to be fun to do that. And then to also explore parts of Spain I've never been to before. I studied there in college in Madrid, but I think I was too busy studying to to do much traveling around the country.
The right thing to do, of course. Thank you so much for your time and for joining me on Out of Office.
Oh, thank you so much.
That was my conversation with Julia Hart, CEO of Eventbrite. I really enjoyed hearing about her journey, especially about her experience working at the Ugly Mug Cafe. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Other episodes of Out of Office are on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Please do check them out when you can. Recent episodes include conversations with makeup entrepreneur Bobby Brown and the president of the CFA Institute, Mark Franklin. I'm Malika Kapoor. As always, thank you for listening.